Hello, 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 everybody. I am Pedro.
And I'm Rudolph.
What the fuck was that? It's over. No. Kill it. It's over. We're canceled the show. I'm leaving. We're done for. I wish this is the only time I wanted a soundboard so I could have done a record scratch right as you did that. No. This is Gritty Reboot, and the show, this is the last show we're doing, ever.
Thought I'd, you know, throw you for a loop. And it appears to be successful.
You very much did. You very much threw me for a loop. I have no idea what to do with myself, and my disappointment is immeasurable, and my day is ruined. All right, so what are we doing today?
We are covering Poltergeist.
That's right, we are covering Poltergeist. Poltergeist is legitimately like a milestone film for me, like one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
I don't even know where to even start with Poltergeist, to be honest. You know, we always talk about like, what are our earliest memories? Like, you know, what do you remember? And for myself, I don't think I have one. Like Poltergeist was just always like a default horror movie that I remember just being on. Yeah. Like it was just on TV a lot. You know, by the time we were kids, like it was just a staple of TBS or USA or whatever network happened to have it at the time.
Yeah, I don't really have a story either.
It just was there.
Pick it up.
Yeah. It's ubiquitous in the late 80s and the early 90s. Really, it wasn't until the early 90s that it really fell out of fashion, and it sort of got locked away, and the sequels took over, which is, I think, an interesting thing we'll talk about a little bit later on as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we just talk about an iconic movies. I mean, it doesn't really get any more iconic than Poltergeist.
Hell yeah.
I mean, with that being said, let's go ahead and start out. What are some facts about the film?
All right. So this movie came out in 1982.
Did it?
Yeah. Heather O'Rourke kept the pet goldfish Carol Ann has in the film.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Oh.
Ooh, interesting.
That's a good fact.
Yeah.
That's fact. That's ever. Quality content. No one heard that and went unsubscribe. Nobody.
Let's get real.
None of this fake shit. Let's get real at this point. Let's get real about Poltergeist.
On October 30th, 1982, Dominic Dunn's ex-boyfriend strangled her unconscious in the driveway of her West Hollywood home. She died on November 4th, having never regained consciousness at the age of 22.
So, yeah, you really did mean get real. So this is a sad as fuck story.
Yeah.
And this is a really terrible tale, domestic violence and a miscarriage of justice as well.
Yeah.
It's amazing. How many years did he actually serve?
Like 6 or something like
that? Yeah, 6 years, I think, is what he got for what is a murder.
Yeah.
He didn't get charged for murder.
He strangled her unconscious.
Yeah.
And then she died later.
Yeah.
Being brain dead.
Yeah, they hit him with manslaughter when he really did murder her. It's a real shame, and it's been a cloud on the production, which is unfair in some way.
Yeah.
He doesn't really deserve that. That's not really what the film is. You know, it's not a product of the movie. This was just domestic violence. That's all this was. The system failed to protect her when she needed it.
Yeah. Not only was Dominic Dunn strangled, but Christopher Tatum in Austin, Texas, was killed with an axe. And he plays one of the guys, you know, the guy that samples the cooking through the window.
Oh, that rude as fuck guy who just comes in her kitchen and is just like, oh, hey, I thought I'd help myself with some of your coffee.
That guy. He was killed with an axe.
Well, he had it coming if he was doing that.
Yeah.
He's like, are you stealing my coffee? And then he just
with an axe, though?
With an axe. Jeez. Don't take my coffee. All right? I take this very, very seriously. Do not take my coffee.
You don't even like coffee.
That's very true. I don't like coffee. Yeah. So take it all. I don't care. I won't axe you to death.
There you go.
I probably won't axe you to death for anything unless you try to axe me to death first.
That's a rough way to go.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. No one was like pro axe death.
True.
Yeah. No one had that.
You got me.
No one's come in with that angle. We're not having a debate about axing here.
No.
No. Okay.
No. Well, there was no debate. Don't worry.
Okay. This is an axing podcast?
No.
Okay.
When filming the scene in which Heather O'Rourke had to hold on to the headboard while a wind machine blew toys in the closet behind her, the young actress fell apart. Producer Steven Spielberg stopped everything, took her in his arms, and said she shouldn't have to do that scene again.
That's what I understand. Is a lot of the stories I read about this is how much Spielberg was there. And we'll talk about this in a little bit. But
he was there a lot.
Yeah, he really was there.
He practically directed.
Yeah, he lived on the set. He never left.
Yeah.
People didn't know he had a little cubby behind some of the house sets. He would live there. That's where he liked to sleep.
Yeah.
Stay away from Kate Capshaw. Oh, she's not in the picture yet. He hasn't met Kate Capshaw. I just introduced a paradox. I apologize.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Real human skeletons were used in the swimming pool scene. Since the crew decided it would be too complicated and expensive to get fake ones, Jo Beth Williams was made aware of this after the scene was finished.
I do want to mention one thing. A lot of people talk about this is one of those things that curses the production. This was a pretty common practice.
Yeah.
This was not like really out of the ordinary. A lot of productions had used real skeletons because they're cheaper and they look a lot more realistic because they're
real
skeletons.
Yeah.
And they're much easier to get than a plastic one. So they just went with that. It's just, like I said, a common thing that's done. And for some reason, it's given far more emphasis in this movie, and I'm not really certain why. I mean, I know it's because people want to build the legend of the curse of the production.
Yeah.
When in reality, it's a lot of unfortunate events.
Originally, Toby Hooper, Steven Spielberg, and the screenwriters were plotting out the screenplay. Carol Ann was going to be killed in the first act and haunt the house in the second. They eventually decided this was too dark and opted to have her kidnapped by the ghosts. Eventually, so many of the dark elements were removed because Spielberg wanted a PG rating, so the film could run as a double feature in the theaters with E.T.
Yeah, I'm really not surprised about that. Spielberg could write some dark stuff, and yeah. I think this really did have a really dark beginning. So a lot of that got toned down into what we get into a final palpable film, but there still is some edges of darkness to it, especially for a PG film, which seems really ridiculous with some of the things that occur in the film. When we think about the PG rating and what we think a PG film really is, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to like what they thought in 1982.
Amen, brother.
Thank you.
Welcome.
But Hulk Hogan just show up.
Yeah. The crawling stake was done by using a real stake, which was laid over a slot cut between the tiles and the countertop. Two wires were fastened to the bottom of the stake, and special effects operator hidden under the counter simply moved the wires to make the stake crawl like a caterpillar. A similar operation was done when Diane presents to Steven the chairs that move across the room by themselves. A wire was fastened to one of the chair's legs, with the wire then dragged across the floor to its destination.
The thing I've always thought during this scene is, who just throws a steak on the countertop like that?
Somebody is very confident in their cleaning skills.
He just throws a like raw piece of meat on the linoleum.
And even then, like, I clean our countertops with bleach wipes. Like, I wouldn't want to lay a steak on a bleach wiped counter.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah.
He's just like, roulette, baby. Let's see what's on that counter. Old macaroni and cheese? Yeah, I'll throw that in there, a little in the marinade. Ew. I just don't know why he'd do that. He deserved to have his face ripped off, is all I'm saying.
Wow.
Yeah.
He didn't actually have his face ripped off.
Yeah, he did.
No.
Yeah, he did. I saw it.
I mean, he did to him.
Thank you. I win.
But he didn't actually have his face ripped off.
It was ripped off. I saw it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Documentary.
Okay.
No.
No.
Okay.
Okay. So crawling steak was pretty cool, though.
It was. It was very cool. I love that scene.
And so were the chairs. But we all know that they use wires in those chairs.
Until this moment, I thought it was dark magic.
You could think that.
Yeah. You ruined the illusion for me.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll be better next.
Thank you.
All right. Jo Beth Williams had a supernatural experience during the making of the film. Whenever she came home from filming, the pictures on the walls of her home were crooked. Every time she fixed them, they would hang crooked again. Zelda Rubinstein also had an experience. When a vision of her dog came to her and said goodbye, hours later, her mother called her and told her that her dog had passed away that very day. Do, 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 do.
I have an anecdote for the Jo Beth Williams story.
Oh, yeah?
I heard her talk about this. I love you guys. I want you to know that. I went back and I watched an E! True Hollywood Story circa 1997 about this film. And she told that story, and then she told an extra part of it where she said she realized when she was on another production that it wasn't the ghost that was doing what she had to come back and grab something. It was the fact that she's a chronic door slammer.
Oh.
And that's what moved all of her paintings every single time that she left the house. Is her horrible, horrible penchant for slamming doors. So just like that, ghost busted. Well, I don't have a sound effect for that. I should have a sound effect for that.
I don't necessarily believe in ghosts either. So if there's a logical explanation, I'm sure there is.
I mean, there usually is.
Zelda Rubinstein is known to say that she sees things from the future. So That's part of her personality.
I think I'm going to have a case later to prove that Zelda Rubinstein is full of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She, of course she is.
No, I'm going to talk about Zelda Rubinstein when you're done with your trivia.
Well, that was it.
That's it? That's all you got?
Yeah.
That's all you got? I didn't know if you had like, you know, I don't know. I thought you had something else.
No.
That was your finisher?
Yeah.
That's what you went out on? That's all right, I guess.
Wow. Jesus Christ.
No, those are good facts. They really are. The thing I like about Poltergeist is it's a wealth of information about this movie because it's classic.
Yeah.
There's one thing I really wanted to talk about coming into it, and I'm glad you didn't have any facts about it.
Before you do, say somebody would want to tell us if these trivia that I've just given are awesome. You would maybe want to email us.
Yeah, email. Don't contact us any other way but email. Yeah, you would want to email us. And the best way to do that would be to email us at grittyrebootcast@gmail.com. That's for any longer sort of email you want to send. A clip of any kind, audio, video.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you want to.
Whatever.
And then if you're looking for another way to get...
No dick pics.
Yeah, no dick pics. No dick pics. I mean, you know, maybe a couple.
What?
No dick pics. No dick pics. Come on, it's not. No. Anyway. What, I can't make a joke to the camera? They're new. Guys, we have cameras in here for the first time. Ooh.
Okay.
So anyway.
Get to it.
You can also find us at Gritty Reboot at Instagram and at TikTok and also on YouTube as well. You also want to look us up on YouTube because we do some video game streams.
Mm-hmm.
We do video game streams. Last week, we live commentaried our way through Night of the Living Dead 30th Anniversary Edition, the travesty that it was. And it was a fun little time, I think.
Yeah.
We spent like 20 minutes just talking about it and just enjoying ourselves.
Yeah, and then we started
Fallout 3. Yeah, we're playing Fallout 3, a little bit of that, streaming here and there. Where I don't know if we'll stream tonight, probably we'll be all talked out after the show. But we could easily be up for streaming again on Wednesday.
Yeah.
I really like doing that. So yeah, look for that. That's another way to get a hold of us. But now I think you interrupted me, so what was I talking about?
Yeah, what are those sweet, sweet facts that you have?
So I want to talk about
Zelda Rubinstein.
So there is an urban legend about this movie that Steven Spielberg directed the film.
Yeah.
And if you don't know, the movie is officially credited to Tobe Hooper, and that is the man who directed Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So no slouch in his own right.
No.
However, I think a lot of people would agree, and I think you might as well, that the film certainly has a Spielbergian flair.
Yes.
That it feels very Spielberg.
Very much so.
And... Well, I think Spielberg himself might say that he overstepped his bounds a little bit. I think I would also say that he wrote the movie, co-wrote it at least, and he did produce the movie. So I would say he did have a lot of say to go in there and be like, hey, we should probably do this instead.
Yeah.
And I think, honestly, it wasn't so much like him being a dick. I think it was all about Tobe Hooper just respecting Steven Spielberg. That when he says, like, I have an idea for this scene, he's like, well, what do you want, boss? You know, I think it could just be that simple. He's like, I know what kind of filmmaker you are, and I know what you really want here, is you want this movie to get made, and you can't do it, and you need me to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Hooper was more than willing to be like, well, what's your input? Because it's not like he's some slouch who has no idea what he's doing. He's Steven fucking Spielberg.
Yeah.
You know, he's the greatest filmmaker around at the time, the hottest guy. Like, if you're making a movie, and Nolan wants to make it, and you're like, listen... You know, because he's bringing him up from a lower level of movies, right?
Yeah.
From making slasher movies to, you know, an A-list Hollywood production. And I think he just was willing to default to Spielberg's expertise. But one of the main reasons this rumor persists is because of Zelda Rubinstein. Zelda hated Tobe Hooper. And in all my research, I couldn't really tell you why. Because you go down the entire list and the cast will tell you up and down like, no, I mean, Steven and I talked about some things, but Tobe Hooper directed the film. It's pretty much that all the way down the line. You know, they would always talk to Spielberg. He was usually there for a lot of the scenes, but Tobe Hooper really was the director. Only Zelda Rubinstein is the one who says, absolutely not, Steven Spielberg directed the film. Now, she has said numerous awful things about Tobe Hooper. And once again, I really have no idea why she absolutely hates him. But
nobody else ever says anything bad about him.
No, not really. And as I said, I researched it and I really couldn't find out why she really kind of slandered him and his directing work on this film. And that's what really led to the myth. You know, she continued to say she was directed by Steven Spielberg and that's the way the movie went down. She was only on the movie for 6 days. 6 days, that's it.
Yeah.
So you know, she could only have a limited perspective. And there's a good chance, I mean, a lot of her scenes are big effect stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're big scenes in the movie. So it makes sense. Steven Spielberg probably would have been there. I should probably call him Steven, like we're buddy. Hey, Stevie, yeah. Steven Spielberg.
I know, right?
But it probably makes sense that Spielberg was there. So I just wanted to mention, like, that's one place where that legend really took off. And I don't know what Zelda Rubinstein's problem was, but she did hate Tobe Hooper. And it's one of the things I want to talk about. I'm kind of put to bed right now that really, Tobe Hooper did direct the movie, even if he did take a lot of input from his producer, Steven Spielberg.
It's good that you have that information, because poor Tobe Hooper, he probably gets overshadowed by Steven Spielberg quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, and it was that way in the marketing, especially too.
Back in the day.
Yeah, the marketing is like Steven Spielberg presents, which, I mean, he did produce it. It's fine. I think we talk about it and Hooper just laughed all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
I think is probably how it really happened. You know, he saw this as what a great opportunity it was for me to write a successful film. And he got to do what he wanted after this one. He made Life Force, which was a terrible failure, but a pretty cool movie. And then he made Invaders from Mars, which was a terrible failure and an awful film. It's a remake, so we might cover it one day. And I have a super soft spot for it. And you're going to be like, I have no idea why you have a soft spot for it, because it's awful. I mean, he got a benefit from this, too. So, I mean, it all worked out. It really did.
Yeah.
Honestly, considering how this film came about, I mean, it really worked out as well as really could have been intended, because really, we just could have not have gotten a film. Because did you want to talk about at all about the history of how we got Poltergeist?
No, go ahead.
Basically, they wanted a sequel to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which made a lot of sense. It was a really successful movie. And Steven Spielberg, while he was making the film, one of his, I guess, not paranormal advisors, but one of his, one of the people he had talked to about a lot of the alien phenomena, his expert, I guess, on the topic, told him about the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter. Or this is often known as the Kelly Green Mean case, or the Hopkinsville Goblins case. And it's exactly what it sounds like. This is a family on a farm. They said that one day invaders from outer space came, little goblins, and they had to fight them off, you know, from basically taking the entire house. And Spielberg fell in love with this story. And he developed an idea called Watch the Skies, or Night Skies, depending on who you talk to. I think it ran by both of those titles. And that movie was a very similar concept. It was about invaders from Mars coming in, or from wherever, and terrorizing a family on a farm. And there was one kind alien that helped them try to get through the attack from the other aliens. And the more Spielberg worked on the idea, the more he realized that he needed to separate the idea, because he fell in love with the idea of a boy and an alien becoming friends, and that would become E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
Yeah.
Which is the movie he absolutely had to make when he came up with the concept. And that's why the other half of Dark Skies really couldn't be made. He presented it to Tobe Hooper, who actually saw it for the first time and said, neat idea, but I don't want to do anything with aliens, and turned it down. Said, make it about ghosts. I don't know. It sort of offhanded comment, and Spielberg immediately said, all right, let's make this about ghosts. He hired a co-writer, and they changed the whole concept to really be about the supernatural to what we see today. And it was a much darker and harder concept. I think you talked about that a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. with Carol Ann dying, and they eventually softened over time to be a bit more of a family horror movie, even though it is sort of ridiculous today to think of it as a PG movie. But that's really how it came about. Tobe Hooper came back on at that point, and they made that movie as Steven Spielberg was making E.T. He was on set for, I mean, he directed E.T. and was on set for this movie a lot. As far as I'm concerned, there might be two or three of them. I'm not really certain how he was able to be on both sets at the same time. Like, yeah. I feel like he's always there when they tell a Poltergeist story. And I know, like, when the fuck's he shooting E.T.?
Well, not to mention, you know, like, Drew Barrymore was supposed to be Carol Ann.
That's right, yeah.
He thought that she would be better in E.T., and he instead went with
Heather O'Rourke
because she looked very angelic.
Yeah, and she wasn't even there to necessarily be cast for the film. He saw her on The Lot, Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
So you can't just get discovered on The Lot. The myth is true. Her sister was there to read for something, and he saw her and was immediately entranced. She kind of bombed her audition, but they brought her back again, and she nailed it. Mm-hmm. And the rest is history.
Yeah.
With that being said, we've kind of covered how this movie came about, one of my favorite controversies about it, some damn good facts about the film. I think it's time we just go ahead and get into it.
Yeah, let's do this.
The house looks just like the one next to it, and the one next to that. And the one next to that. A young couple live in it.
Give Ken a kiss.
You are so unlucky.
With their three children.
Sexy bitch in that camera.
And something more.
I'm glad you disagree.
last night? Do you remember when you
woke up? So as we've said, in the year 1982, we get Poltergeist. It drops a few weeks before E.T., as a matter of fact. They both make a fuck ton of money and become cultural icons and classics.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I mean, there's no real reason. It's a hit, guys. Yeah.
I haven't watched E.T. since I was a kid, and I think I want to keep it that way.
And we've seen this film at least once every couple of years, yeah, if not more.
Poltergeist's movie we'll watch at least a few times a year.
Well, I think it's a testament to its quality. Now that we just don't get it in reruns, we're like, no, let's actually seek out Poltergeist and watch it.
Yeah.
So, and it's always a hell of a time, as it was this time.
All right. So you ready to get going on this?
Let's do it. Let's get into the film.
A TV is left on and is playing shots of basically the monuments and the Washington Monument and stuff like that. And it's what you used to play when...
End of broadcast day.
The end of broadcast day.
Yeah.
And then the Star-Spangled Banner.
Yeah. I remember our local CBS did a really somber prayer right before they left air and then just showed the American flag.
Yeah.
They would do that like right after Letterman. They weren't kidding around.
Yeah. It was really bad. A man has fallen asleep. There's a golden retriever wandering from room to room.
Man has fallen asleep.
A
random man has wandered into the Rawlings home.
The golden retriever finally ends with Carol Ann. She gets woken up and goes downstairs and sees the TV playing nothing but fuzz. She stares at it and says hello.
This is the first time we get introduced to that concept of her communicating with the TV.
Yeah. She answers questions and then her dad wakes up and that's the man that...
That's the man, Craig T. Nelson, the coach himself.
Yeah.
Who's fantastic in this movie.
And he's kind of wondering what's going on. But it basically just shrugs it all off.
Yeah.
And puts her back to bed. And this is where we have the opening credits. And we see an idyllic neighborhood, kids playing, lawns are all kept.
Yeah, it's a beautiful vision of like 1980 suburbs.
Yeah.
Exactly what everybody would have loved and dreamt for. I mean, it's a fun idea. They got this guy... He's got a case of beer in his hand and he's on a bicycle. The worst way he could have transported a case of beer.
Yeah. And it's
other like than a unicycle.
He's got like a 24 pack.
Yeah. Yeah.
Six pack increments. It's pretty hard to handle.
Yeah. He literally has it in the hardest way he could possibly have it. That sounded dirty.
He drops a bunch of the beer in the street and runs into the house. So he wastes like half
of it, easily half of it.
He only has probably like 8 beers.
Yeah.
And he's going into
what a dumb fuck. Too far?
Steven's house, and they're all watching the game. And they have this really weird setup where their neighbors are part of their cable package. So like if one of them decides to jump on the TV, they have to watch whatever that person's watching.
I don't think it's a cable package thing. Their remotes are on the same RF signal.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, that's what it is. They're not using an infrared signal. They're using like a radio signal to do it.
Yeah.
And because of that, like they happen to have the same model. So the same remotes work for the same one. It's a problem that does not matter today and would be really weird to anybody watching who was born after 1997.
Weird. Yeah. The mother tidies the room and notices a bird is dead. And this is the mother of Carol Ann.
Jo Beth Williams.
Craig T. Nelson is fighting with his neighbor over watching the game because, like I explained, they have the same channel
changer. Yeah, we understand the situation.
Yeah.
We got it.
All right. All right. Mother and Carol Ann have a funeral for the bird. So they have this nice little moment where they put it in a
shoebox. As a parent, there's a nice moment where it's like, oh, why couldn't you have died on a weekday?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you just could have gone to a store, picked up another one, and just not dealt with that problem. Yeah. Instead, they had to have a funeral for a bird.
Yeah, and then she ends up with a goldfish.
Yeah. I think they do an incredible job introducing this family. Poltergeist doesn't really start off like a lot of other horror movies, especially haunted house films, because we're not in a secluded area or anything like that. We're in the middle of a neighborhood, a modern home, as a matter of fact, in the middle of a neighborhood.
Yeah, we meet Robbie. He's climbing a tree in the front yard.
An evil tree.
And he sees a storm rolling in while he's climbing the tree.
This is a very, like, matte painting storm, by the way. I love a good 80s matte painting storm.
Yeah.
Storms are very ominous.
It's very liquidy.
Yeah. It's like the storm at the end of Terminator.
Like God took a liquid shit all over the sky.
By God, you're a poet. I knew when I married you, you would string prose together that would make me weep.
Well, it's pretty accurate. All right.
I'm sorry. Does that make you feel better? Does that make you feel better?
No, it doesn't. Robbie and Carol Ann are in their room. Robbie's looking at the spooky tree out of his window. And, you know, already it's nighttime and the movie has great atmosphere.
It does a good job putting you in the shoes of a kid and the things they could possibly be scared of.
Mm-hmm.
I got to watch a very fun clip of Steven Spielberg's sister talking about him being afraid of a big old tree that was in their yard when they were kids.
Yeah.
And that obviously that idea came all the way through here, but I got to see pictures of a little baby Steven Spielberg. And she talked about how it really freaked him out when he was young. And we see that child fear really projected here.
Yeah. It's pretty, I think he also had an aversion for clowns or something else about this movie.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, he just hated clowns.
Yeah.
Him and King made an entire generation of Americans afraid of clowns.
Yeah.
They ruined the profession of clowning.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Poor clowns.
Yeah.
Diane and...
She's part of the clown lobby. Don't trust her.
Diane and Steven are smoking doobies.
They're smoking doobs.
And while watching an old movie.
I remember... I think it was on Comcast once. The description for the film was, two stoner parents refused to move their family out of a haunted house. And I was like, well, I mean, yeah, that does occur in the film, but that's not really what the takeaway of the movie is. All right.
Kidding.
Yeah. That is a gross representation of what occurs.
Yeah. Not kidding.
Yeah. I did not agree.
Diane tells a really funny story and it makes Steven laugh pretty hearty.
Yeah.
They joke around. They have a good marriage and they have good chemistry.
Yeah. they have a great chemistry. Makes this whole marriage thing work. There's so many movies where you just don't buy anything in this marriage. And that's okay if it's a marriage that's falling apart, like a movie like Vacancy.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's a great movie about two people that hate each other.
Robbie is trying not to let things scare him, but he looks at the spooky clown and puts a jacket over its head.
As you would.
Robbie goes to his parents' bedroom and basically tells him that he's scared, but they pretty much brush him off and tell him to go back to bed. Yeah. So he does. Steven actually takes him back to his room. He tells his dad about the spooky tree and dad reassures him that the tree is here to protect him, that it's really old and that's what it does. And
dad's full shit.
Also, to count the storm, the thunder, and that's how you know when the next, or count the lightning, and that's how you know when the next thunderclap's going to be. So you can anticipate the
storm's getting closer, further away and stuff.
Yeah.
Some classic dadding stuff. Dadding it up.
But eventually, the kids end up in their parents' bed anyways.
That's what happens when kids are scared.
Static comes on the TV, and Karen Lynn notices it. She wakes up, and some weird things start happening. A ghost hand reaches out of the TV, a bright light hits the wall, and the bed rumbles and shakes, and Carolyn says, "They're here.
They're here." Yeah, so this is an iconic line. This is in all the trailers. If I let that trailer play through, that's what it ends on, her saying that. And, you know, at one point in the script, or at least I think they shot some of this, that mark on the wall leaves a stain, and a stain that only grows bigger. And they cut that whole storyline out of the film.
Yeah.
This is its genesis right there. And this is a pretty cool scene.
Next morning, all the kids are eating breakfast. Diane asks Carol Ann about what she meant by "they're here." Carol Ann watches the static on the TV. Robbie notices the spoon he was using is bent.
Yeah, his utensils are all fucked up.
And then we get a scene. We actually meet their 16-year-old daughter, Dana.
Yeah, Dana.
Yeah. And she gets catcalled by a bunch of construction workers.
So this is a very 80s sort of scene. They openly catcall a 16-year-old high schooler.
Yeah.
And she just flips them off. And it's all good. Like, the mom sees them and is like, oh, good American fun.
Yeah.
Like, that's sort of the attitude.
Proud of her dog.
Yeah, that's sort of the attitude of it. Just a very different time. Like, that was like an open thing you could do in 1982 or 81 when they shot this.
Well, the dog is acting strange. And he's acting strange to the mark on the wall that was left the night before where the light hit it.
Yeah.
Diane just brushes it off.
That was the beginning of the stain that's not there anymore.
She goes back to the kitchen and all the chairs are pulled out from the table. She pushes them all back in, goes and does something, and comes back and the chairs are all stacked.
This is some old school effects work. you know, just pan one way, pan back the other way, and something's different that couldn't possibly happen unless you had a talented crew on the other side putting all that together as quickly as possible.
Some poor grips out there just ripping and whirling.
Yeah. He just threw a whole bunch of chairs. He learned to just throw 8 of them up at one time and they landed that way.
Yeah.
It took 8 takes, but they got it.
We see Steven doing his job as a real estate agent. He's showing a house to a couple. And it's a house in the area where they're going to put like phase 2 or phase 3 or
whatever. Yeah, and it's very similar to their house.
Yeah. We see another storm roll in. Steven gets home to his wife, yanks him inside.
More matte painting storms.
She begs him to have an open mind, and he's like, okay, what's this about? She gets a chair and puts it in a circle she's drawn, and the chair ends up moving on its own. She puts Carol Ann in a helmet and puts her in the circle and moves her across the floor.
Yeah, it's adorable.
Diane describes...
And Carol Ann is great because she's, as a kid, she's just no-selling this phenomenon entirely.
Yeah, she's like, do I have to do it again?
Yeah, she's more concerned about getting pizza.
Yeah. And then Diane describes the sensation that you get when it moves you to Steven. And he's kind of like a little bit amazed.
Yeah, just like a little bit.
Yeah.
Like he's had a hard day. He doesn't really know what to make of this. He can't make anything of it. So he's confused, but he's still really tired.
Mm-hmm. They go next door to talk to the neighbors.
Which I think is a really underrated scene in this movie. Because they go and talk to this neighbor and they can't stop giggling about what they're about to ask him.
Yeah, because it's just preposterous.
So I did want to talk about one of the early drafts of the movie. As a couple, they were sort of not on the rocks, but they weren't as close and as warm as they are in this one. They would snipe at each other a little bit. They would have, you know, more snarky comments back and forth. And they went a different way with the final version. And I think that was a fantastic idea because this movie really depends a lot on their performances and on their relationship and their chemistry. It's almost perfect. As perfect as you could really have it.
They have just extraordinary chemistry.
Yeah, their chemistry is one of the few highlights of the sequel. Few.
Well, they have a fun moment with the neighbors, and then they end up laughing their way back home. The storm comes, and Robbie starts counting the lightning strikes. The tree comes to life and grabs Robbie.
Yeah, this is actually a pretty wicked effect.
Steven tries to grab him. The closet opens and there's a white light emanating from it. While the parents are busy with Robbie, the closet starts sucking all the toys into it. Carol Ann can barely hold on. Steven gets Robbie from the tree. A tornado comes and grabs the tree. And then they all realize Carol Ann is left in the house. They go for it and she's not there. They see a pile of toys basically in the closet. And they start digging, trying to dig her out, but she's not there.
Yeah. There's a fake scare with the clown. It's covered in a sheet, and they think it's Carol Ann. They pull it back, and it's just that stupid clown.
They go looking for her. They think she's ended up in the swimming pool. So
which is a nice moment of real world terror. Yeah.
Yeah, of parents.
She's just like, where could she? Oh, my God. You know, they haven't looked. It's the only place they haven't looked. And, you know, there's a mad rush out there.
Yeah.
And he dives in the pool and immediately starts looking around. They can't find her there either.
Robbie, meanwhile, hears Carol Ann in the TV. Carol Ann calls out from the TV. She says she can't see her. And Robbie starts freaking out.
I'm not really certain how they got this kid to have this look on his face. But he is absolutely fucking terrified.
Yeah,
when he hears Carol Ann.
What's going on?
Yeah, because it's a perfect look of just like he doesn't understand it, but he knows he's just afraid. Whatever it is, it terrifies him to his core. And just it helps make the scene when they come in and understand what's going on.
Like you said, they have this moment where Robbie's telling his mother, Carol Ann, Carol Ann. He's saying that over and over again, but he's basically saying it to the TV.
Yeah.
And finally, the mother gets it.
Yeah.
She's in the TV somehow or somewhere. We don't know. We don't know anything yet. All right, so next scene is Steven. He's going to see a parapsychologist.
And this is actually one of the movie's best characters, even though the Zelda Rubinstein will eventually steal the film from everybody.
They all come to the house. It's a woman and two guys.
It's a woman and two guys.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get their names.
It's okay. They don't have names.
Steven explains they don't go into the room anymore. When Steven opens the room, things are floating on their own and the bed is spinning. This terrifies the parapsychologist. There's this fun scene where the female parapsychologist, the main one, she's like shaking while she's
and this this is one of the movies. I mean, this is a true comedic moment because one of the scientists talks to them about capturing an event that took like 16 hours for a matchbox to move across the table.
Yeah.
And they open it up and like, it's not just a little bit of stuff, like all this wild, wacky, paranormal shit is going on the other side. And it really is like wacky. There's a light bulb that slides in a lamp and turns on. There's a record that plays in the air just off a needle. You know, there's some really wild stuff. And it does have a great conclusion of her hand shaking as she's trying to put that back down again.
While they're having tea, the teapot moves on its own. They all are just flabbergasted. The main parapsych tells them they have a poltergeist. And I'm sorry, I keep saying it wrong. I'm used to adding an R, like poltra, but it's poltergeist.
Poltergeist. Yeah. I didn't know you were trying to say it like that.
Yeah, I've been saying, I've got to stop.
Poltergeist. Yeah, I never had an issue with how it was spelled.
That's just always how I said it.
Yeah.
Since I was a kid, so. Diane shows them all how she can contact Carol Ann. And then she shows them that she starts saying her name. The dog starts acting funny. They make contact finally with Carol Ann. She says she's afraid. And she's afraid of the light. They tell her to stay away from the light. She says there's someone here with her.
Yeah, so this is the first time. So this is sort of strange. The movie doesn't really have an antagonist. And never really gets an antagonist besides the house. And this is the first time we have some sort of threat. I mean, we know it's not good that she's on the other side, but now we know there's something else there with her.
Yeah.
But we don't know its nature.
A portal opens up and a bunch of old watches and stuff comes right out.
Yeah, a bunch of old jewelry and like some coins and stuff.
But it varies in its times because there's like a digital watch in one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's like some old money and stuff I think that's there. Mm-hmm. So
we have a scene where Mom feels Carol Ann move through her soul. And then,
yeah, this is actually a really sweet moment because she kind of goes up these stairs, these windy stairs. I like that these really play these stairs for their odd shape. And we see all these ghostly things on them. She steps up and just has this moment. And Jo Beth plays it really fantastically where she turns around. She just feels like utter joy because she could smell her one more time.
Yeah. But Steve has a malevolent soul move through him.
Yeah. And it bites his ass.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of the parapsychs guys gets
Marty.
Bit. Yeah.
Marty gets bit. The one who wasn't Beyonce's stepfather.
They talk about there being a way into where Carol Ann is. And Diane and the parapsych lady have a nice moment again where they share a drink.
And this is a good scene. The
parapsych lady has a flask.
Yeah. This is a really good scene because she goes down this entire like speech to Robbie about the afterlife.
Yeah.
And I was going to clip it, but I couldn't find a really high quality copy of it. But that's all she does. And it's sort of creepy, but reassuring at the same time about the light
mm-hmm.
and the only information about it. I think it's one of the movie's better sequences. That's not pure ghost action, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really nice.
This movie has a lot of quiet, really great quiet moments.
Yeah. Good acting, interacting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's built off these character moments. There's still some of that Spielberg magic.
Robbie asks questions about the afterlife. He doesn't know why his dead grandpa isn't with Carol Ann right now. And then Diane basically mentions to Robbie that he's going to go stay with grandma for a little bit.
Which is probably for the best. We meet grandma in the next movie. She saves the day.
Everyone is asleep except some of the parasite guys. One of the guys helps himself to food and takes out a steak.
I think that's Marty.
He puts the steak on the counter. He knows it crawling on the counter, then it morphs into something horrifying.
It bursts full of tumors.
Yeah.
I believe it was written as a cancerous steak. It looks it.
He goes to a sink. In the mirror, his face starts to come off.
Yeah, there's this really horrifying scene where he just reaches up, and then at one point, it's a clear dummy, and he just starts ripping his face off. And it's amazing they got away with this in a PG movie. By the way, do you know whose hands that is? That's Spielberg.
Oh.
Yeah, so they didn't want Spielberg to be upset with how the effect turned out, so they made him be the one who actually ripped it down.
This scene I remember vividly because this was the first horror movie that our niece had ever seen.
Yeah.
And we we corrupted her early. And she was terrified by this.
Oh, yeah, she absolutely was.
Yeah.
We did our job as our aunt and uncle. Yeah.
Well, his face comes off, but then eventually it's fine, and he freaks out.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that's his last day there.
With the other guy, the cameras start moving on their own. There's a light coming from upstairs. An apparition comes from the light. It moves towards them, then suddenly disappears.
That's a really good-looking old-school effect.
They run back the tape and they recorded it. They see all the bunch of ghosts through
the light. Yeah, it's like individual lights of each ghost coming through.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different than what we saw before.
Yeah, and it's like a bunch of old people in hats and old garb.
Old garb.
Old garb.
Old garb. Renaissance fair people. there's a knight.
Yeah.
Let's see. There's the Stone Age guy.
Whatever, dude.
There's the samurai.
Then we get yet another nice moment with Diane and the female parasite chick.
Like, I'm coming back.
Yeah.
Don't worry. I'm coming back no matter what.
She's not. That's when she says
that Marty isn't coming, but she's not going to leave this family just to stew out here and let their daughter just fade away into nothing.
Yeah. The next scene is a funny moment where Steve's boss comes over and Steve has to hide all the paranormal stuff that's happening.
Yeah, he's trying to direct around the house. It's like the piano moves on his own.
Yeah.
And he steps outside and the light almost explodes.
Yeah.
You got terrible wiring here. What's going on with that? Like, it's a problem we're working on. Then we have a sequence where he takes him out of the house. And one of the few times we leave the house, really, in the second half of the film. And we get introduced to this idea of this new land he's going to develop. You know, he's going to ruin the view of the other people there. But this is the new land that has to move. But they have to move the cemetery first.
Mm-hmm.
And we get introduced to this concept that freaks Craig T. Nelson out, obviously. But obviously, we know he's got the willies at this point. So
in parallel to that moment, Diane is doing the laundry. And she knocks on Carol Ann's locked bedroom door. She doesn't hear anything, but she opens it anyways, and it's just screaming.
Oh, yeah, just this demonic yell. This is such a great little quiet moment.
Mm-hmm.
She just wants to feel her daughter again. You know, she just for a moment, like, maybe she's just in there. And Joe Beth Williams plays it perfectly. Like, she just thinks for 1 second and, like, how she screams and, like, the look of anguish. Like, I was an idiot, you know, to think that. But she had to take that chance. She missed her little girl.
Yeah.
It was a heartbreaking little scene in this movie.
Boss and Steven are talking about phase 5 and that they have to move the cemetery. And then the true start of the movie comes when Zelda Rubinstein hits. And her name is Tangina in this movie.
Yeah, this is where we introduce Tangina, and she'll be in all 3 movies.
She comes in and goes upstairs and wants to know why the door is locked to the kid's bedroom. Tangina tells Diane her daughter is alive and in this house.
It is only a transition to a different sphere of consciousness. Carol Ann is not like those she's with. She is a living presence in their spiritual earthbound plane. They're attracted to the one thing about her that's different from themselves. Her life force. It is very strong. It gives off its own illumination. It is a light that implies life and memory of love and home. And earthly pleasures. Something they desperately desire, but can't have anymore.
So, yeah, Zelda's going to have a lot of exposition and yet still steal every scene at this point in the movie.
Yeah, I'm mesmerized by her.
Yeah, she really is great.
The real light that has finally come for them. Do you understand me? These souls, who for whatever reason are not at rest, are also not aware that they have passed on. They're not part of consciousness as we know it. They linger in a perpetual dream state, a nightmare from which they cannot wake.
She really will just, like, literally just state out all the mysterious stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's like, yeah, they're ghosts, you know, they got nowhere to go, Carol Ann's, well, you know, what they like.
She does my job for me.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
The friends are waiting to guide.
She was helping you out all the way back then.
Right?
Carol Ann must help them cross over, and she will only hear her mother's voice. No. Hold on to yourselves. There's one more thing. A terrible presence is in there with her. So much rage.
So this is why I wanted to play it, because we introduce Dredd here. A Jerry Goldsmith score changes.
I don't know what hovers over this house, but it was strong enough to punch a hole into this world, take your daughter away from you. He keeps Caroline very close to it, and away from the spectral light. It lies to her. It says things only a child can understand. It has been using her to restrain the others. To her, it simply is another child. To us, it is the beast.
So there, and just like that, we have an antagonist for the back half of the film.
Yeah, and this is where they put a plan into action. And Diane calls for Carol Ann. Steven has to call her now because he administers the punishment. So
Zelda. Yeah, and this is a really fun scene between them because I like this when, well, who gives the punishments? Like, well, Steve's the one who decides that. Like, well, no, I'm not the sterner one. Like, they have this debate back and forth. And this whole time, this shot is almost a oneer, except for the gentleman downstairs. But they go back and forth, really. I mean, up and down, pardon me. They go from Zelda's perspective up to Craig T. Nelson's. And to Joe Beth, like, they go back and forth like a close-up of everybody in the room as they're just yelling at this spot just past the camera where Carol Ann theoretically is as they go through this. And this whole scene is a roller coaster of emotion as you deal with, you know, who is the more strict parent to basically eventually telling her she has to run into the light.
Yeah. Tangina wants her to tell Carol Ann to go into the light. They open the dreaded door. Tangina goes through it, and she stands in front of the light and asks for a tennis ball, number one. She throws it into the light. The ball comes back.
Yeah, it's covered in some ectoplasm, but it's there. It's on the other side.
Now she wants Diane's hand. They go towards the light. They throw the rope into the light, and it comes out to the other side. Take up the slack gently. They fight over who's going in after her. But Diane basically says she's not going to come to you. She's going to come to me. I'm her mother.
Makes sense.
So Diane takes the rope.
There's a nice little moment when she's like, you've never done this before. Neither of you. All right, fair enough. Now get in there. Like I said, Zelda's really great.
Tangina tells the spirits to go towards the light. Steven starts pulling on the rope too early because he's wondering what the hell Tangina's doing.
There's a great shot before this where they kiss right in front of the portal that I love.
Yeah, they tell her to go towards the light. They tell her to not go towards the light. It's really confusing. So Steven starts pulling on the rope early. And then a giant demon head
pulls out the beast, basically. We see his skull head come out.
Yeah.
It's one of the best scares in the movie. It scared the crap out of our daughter.
The parasite gal pulls on the rope on the other end. And Diane and Carol Ann come through covered in goo. They take them to the bathtub to revive them. And they do. Next thing you know, you see the family packing up. They are moving, getting the hell out of there.
We did miss that this house is clean.
Oh, yeah.
Which it is not. She's a damn charlatan is what she is.
Yeah.
I mean, she did save the girl, but whatever.
You can see Diane has a gray streak through her hair.
Which makes sense.
She went there and back.
Yeah, she went through some sort of supernatural trauma. And that's Hollywood speak for you were scared so much. You had gray hair now. I like it. I do.
They banter. Steve goes to the office one last time. Diane hears the kids playing. She runs a bath and is planning to dye her hair and get rid of the streak. The kids put themselves to bed and the clown still being creepy.
And I like it too, because if you're expecting sort of like the falling action at the end of a movie, at some point when she steps in the tub, as a viewer, you're aware it's gone on too long.
Yeah.
We're not ending the movie. Something else is happening.
Robbie wakes up and the clown is missing. He looks under the bed, and when he comes up, he's being attacked by the clown.
Yeah, it wraps around him and starts choking him, and actually did choke him on set, by the way. He had to be saved by Steven Spielberg himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They thought he was just acting, and they realized he was turning blue. The animatronic just... Oh. Animatronics bust all the time, so you have to be very careful.
Wow.
Yeah, and they pulled him free.
Cool. Steven Spielberg and kids, man.
Steven Spielberg, not letting children die since 1982.
Yeah. He's no Jonathan Landis.
Yeah. Jonathan Landis. He's a man now. Sorry.
Diane is clueless, but she lays on the bed and ends up being attacked.
And yeah.
She rolls on the ceiling. And
in the original cut of the scene, this is where the stain was up in the corner. And it had like big, like hairy tentacles that came out from the spot that those kind of molested her as she was moving up and down the ceiling as well. So they went back and reshot it for this version because they felt that was too gross.
Yeah. I think that's a good call.
Yeah. They're too gross. Too hentai with those tentacles.
And then the light comes back for Carol Ann.
Yeah, the closet just swings itself open and immediately, like, they know what's up, that they're in deep shit.
Diane goes for Carol Ann and a giant ghost creature growls at her.
Yeah, there's this really impressive and scary looking effect. Poltergeist isn't necessarily the world's scariest movie, but it's a hell of a roller coaster ride.
Yeah.
So she has this creature right in front of her and she's like, get away from my babies.
She goes outside and falls in the pool. And this is where we see a bunch of skeletons and coffins start popping up everywhere.
Yeah.
She goes and begs for help from the neighbors.
Who are mystified. To be fair, they should be like, you know, they step over there. They're like, why is there corpses popping up all over your yard?
Yeah.
No, I think I'm gonna watch Price is Right. I'm gonna stay in here. You guys do whatever. I'm gonna watch That's Incredible.
And then Diane goes to save her kids. And Steven comes back.
There's a great push-pull. She runs down this hallway where it looks like it extends for like 300 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great push-pull. One of my favorites in cinema as she's running her ass. She just refused to give up and just runs right through that goddamn optical effect to go get her kids.
Mm-hmm.
Only to open the door and almost be sucked into hell.
But she saves them.
And Steven comes back in and he's with the real estate guy. And we get my favorite line of the film.
You son of a bitch, you moved the cemetery, but you left the bodies, didn't you? Son of a bitch, you left the bodies and you only moved the headstones! You only moved the headstones!
I love his inarticulate cries of terror at the end of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like he just realized everything's come back to roost for him.
And we end with them going to a Holiday Inn and removing the TV.
Yeah, throwing the TV right out on the...
Right out.
Yeah, on the balcony. And it's a good way to end the movie. It's a nice little gag. And we get the reprise of the Carol Ann theme to sort of peacefully end the movie. By the way, fun fact, that Carol Ann theme has lyrics.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. On the original soundtrack, there's a version where someone sings over it. Talks about how angelic she is, I believe. I don't have a clip of it because I didn't go to that distance. Sorry. I just have clips.
You
of,
didn't
I only have clips. Distance. I only have clips of Craig T. Nelson yelling at things.
Are you ready for reviews?
Oh, I am.
Oh, yeah, baby.
I hope you got me a fat, idiotic one-star review for this film.
I did. I found somebody that really hated this movie. This movie got 4.0 user review, 88% on Rotten Tomatoes, 7.3 out of 10 on IMDb, and a 79% on Metacritic. And yes, oh yes, I found a one-star review. This one-star review is called Vastly Overrated.
Vastly overrated.
Vastly.
Vastly.
This film is not without merits, but it certainly is no classic. It's aged badly. The characterization is poor, and there are at least a dozen things about it that really grate. The fact that the whole film is an excuse to use special effects. The fact that everyone blindly accepts the existence of ghosts and attributes any strange happenings to them without considering any other explanation. The cheesy horror cliches, the annoying, sickly suburban family.
We don't have time for that.
The odd morale of the tale. Treat those corpses with respect or else. The American dream gone wrong theme, which doesn't quite work, given the fact that it is a 10 on the DAF scale. And last but not least, the fact that one of the paranormal investigators is scared half to death by the crawling meat scene. And yet 10 minutes ago, he was happily documenting dozens of levitating objects flying around a bedroom.
Well, I think he had his fill. That was the point.
That said, the special effects are quite good for the time, and acting does it best with such a daft story. At this point, you may be thinking, this guy just doesn't like the genre. Not true. But in my opinion, effectively, truly scary horror is created by the maxim less is more. not the more is more approach that Spielberg has employed successfully in other films and less well here. A disappointment. Go watch The Ring instead for truly creepy television antics.
Wow.
One last thing.
Oh, one more.
Appalling this got a PG in the U.S.
Fair enough.
One particularly disgusting scene involving peeling flesh is clearly unsuitable for kids, and I can imagine this giving young children nightmares, as hokey as it is. I suggest your kids should be at least 12 before you watch this with them.
So Spielberg used the clips of Raiders of the Lost Ark where the faces melted for the precedent to get a PG, and that worked. They should have been like, no, we made a mistake back then. But they were like, you know what, Steven? You're right, because they got an R rating originally. And as far as I know, they didn't cut anything and got a PG. So that was the power of Steven Spielberg to just mold the MPAA to his will.
Yeah.
They finally done with it when they were ripping hearts and not Raiders of the Lost Ark, but Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
That's when they made a PG-13.
Well, that's all I have for you.
Yeah, that guy's review, he was not a fan to say the least.
No.
I don't really agree with him. But it was a good review to end on. You know, you need a one star every now and then, especially of a classic movie, because you want to hear some irrational hatred of it. But, you know, that's going to do it for our show. I want to thank that. It's not the end of our show, is it? I like how you give me a look, like you just roll your eyes every time I do this gag. But, you know, in the year of 1982, Roger Ebert was very much alive. And also alive Gene Siskel. Reviewed live to both of them. Yeah, two for one. They both reviewed Poltergeist. I almost forgot what we were doing. Do you think they liked it?
Yeah,
of course, right? It's a classic film. Of course they would both love it, right? Couldn't go any other way but that.
Next film is Steven Spielberg's new horror movie Poltergeist.
Toby Hooper just doesn't exist.
Fuck Toby Hooper.
Yeah.
Using the latest special effects technology, but it works best, I think, when it only suggests the terrible things that exist just beyond the boundaries of everyday life. Early in the film, for example, a little girl in a typical suburban home calmly announces to her parents that she's in touch with the television people. Well, who are the television people? Well, naturally, they're the people who live in the TV set when it's tuned to an empty channel. They're here, and they really are there, too.
There was a clip there, but you guys know how the film goes.
Later in the film, the family becomes completely dominated by evil spirits, which possess the house and kidnap that little girl and take her off through her bedroom closet into another dimension. The family calls in a professional psychic who tries to explain where the missing girl was taken to and why. I guess the idea is that the TV people, or the spirits in possession of this house, have occupied that closet and it's in the fourth dimension, so you can kind of go through it and come out through the living room ceiling. The whole last half of this...
I mean, it is ridiculous, but it's also a ghost movie.
...as evil spirits play games with the family's sanity. Well, why are these spirits so disturbed? Turns out the real bad guys in Poltergeist are the same villains Steven Spielberg used in his hit movie Jaws, the local real estate developers. This time, instead of telling people it's safe to go back in the water, they've been up to other dirty tricks. I'm not even going to tell you what they did, but they shouldn't have. The whole movie is just that silly, and we never do find out if a real poltergeist was involved in the strange event.
It's a new word to him.
But Poltergeist is a good...
Not to us. We grew up with Poltergeist. It's new to him.
It's not a great movie.
A moderate recommendation.
Our first disagreement. I feel so bad about this picture that I think that I'm starting to like Rocky 3 a little bit more.
Gene Siskel, Rocky 3 versus Poltergeist. Rocky 3, the better picture.
Wow. That's insane.
Beginning of the picture. Then all this mumbo jumbo about spectral light, afterlife. I felt that I was not too far from that garbage movie we once made a dog of the week, Beyond and Back. I thought that this, Roger...
Siskel's a pure hater. Rarely is he a hater, but man, he hates this movie.
I never understood it. I haven't talked to a single person that could tell me what is going on in this
movie. I'll meet you after the show. All I have to say is I think the movie works as entertainment. It's not great.
It's not great.
Okay. I'll tell you one thing, though, that I would like to make, and this is probably an important point. This movie is about a little girl who finds out that the toys in her bedroom are going to try to strangle her, that people are in her bedroom closet and going to pull her out of bed and take her away from mommy and daddy. Yeah. This is a PG-rated film. I think for young kids, it's too strong. If I had seen this movie when I was 7, I would have been afraid to go to bed until I was 12.
I think it's probably too strong for young people, but I don't think that they should even bother with it. I think there's a better film, much better films around this summer. I think that this
including
film,
the next film.
I really think that this is, and I think when you say it's good special effects, I'm going to accuse you of something, which is being intimidated by
them.
Effects. Anybody can do these special effects now, and this doesn't have a convincing story at all.
Just because anyone can do it doesn't mean they aren't done well.
They're both unwell.
The point is, the next movie, why don't you get to the next
You've grown to hate Roger Ebert through this show.
And a story. And
he's wrong. We a lot.
He gave it a thumbs up. A suburban or family's haunted a yes.
House. Gene thought it was predictable and not scary. He votes no. I like the special effects. I wasn't intimidated by them. And I like the portrait of a family under fire. I vote yes. But we both agree on one thing. Despite the PG rating, that this film is too
That's
extreme
fair.
For
it
young
really
children.
Is. It yeah. should not have got a PG. Even then, they were like, this is bullshit, MPAA.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to note. And that's it.
That's it.
That's all we have on Poltergeist until we meet again next week to talk about a somewhat forgettable, if albeit somewhat well-made reboot.
Middling.
Yeah, it's middle of the road, but we'll check it out. We'll give it our review, and we'll see if it stands up a little bit better 7 years later than it did all the way back in 2016, 2017.
I don't know. I have to look.
Yeah, it could be 2015. I have to check. But either way, we're going to check it out next week and be back with a fresh review of that one. So we'll talk to you guys later.
Ciao.